Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Your Cases on Hold, number 34. We're glad to have you back, and we just want to make sure to let you know that the opinions are fully our own, and they do not represent anything with regards to JBJS. I'm Antonia Chen. I've apparently not said that adult reconstruction is the best subspecialty in a while, so I have to say that. Adult reconstruction, best subspecialty in the world, deputy editor. And we have here...
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, and I'll have the pancakes and the Age of Enlightenment that you're supposed to say, hang on there, Voltaire. That's your line.
I'm working on it. Hang on there, Voltaire.
The episode covering the May 17th issue of the journal. And in celebration of that, and it's funny that you brought up total joints as the premier subspecialty in our field, we have a little Your Case is on Hold bingo card for those who want to, you know, go back and follow along, and you can see how long it takes you to get bingo. So here are the bingo square categories. Kaiser Soze, of course, that's like episode one right there. Antonia does evil laugh. Yeah, there you go. Antonia references joints as the best subspecialty. Andrew name drops an LVMH product. Any LVMH product will do. A Key and Peele reference, direct or suggested. Plato's Cave. Wakanda Total Joint Registry. Any Usual Suspects reference, not Kaiser Soze, because that character does come from that movie. Any rap verse dropped over the course of the episode. Antonia presents a total joint article as her headline. Any Seinfeld reference. And my intro affiliation line is not legitimate. Anytime my intro affiliation is incorrect, such as when I said that I worked for the Yokohama Corporation.
And what's your intro line today?
It was, I'll have the pancakes in the Age of Enlightenment.
That's right. That's right. But that's real.
That's real.
That is real.
The menu said you can have breakfast in any age, anytime.
And then that's also real. So that would not be a bingo card this time, but there's plenty of other ones,
more than enough to go around.
All right. Well, we'll have this bingo card ready to go. And prizes are, you get to listen to this podcast. This
episode, Your Cases on Hold Bingo and Hyponatremia in Total Joint Arthroplasty.
That one is arthroplasty one for both of us to discuss. Right, so that is.
But pretty sure your headline in this episode is also on total joints.
Check. So this is being sponsored by Clinical Classrooms. So if you haven't gotten to Clinical Classrooms, get your learn on. You can learn about all the different subspecialties in orthopedics in a very succinct, compact, and educational way through JBJS Clinical Classrooms. Without further ado, we're going to start off with the top of the pile today. What's new in foot and ankle surgery? It's by Hembry et al. It's permanently free, so we can all learn what's up and coming in foot and ankle surgery. The evidence-based orthopedic articles, there's three of them there to take a look at. What's important? Treating just the fracture, is it ever okay? This is by Krukan et al. It's also permanently free. And what's important, the patient perspective, going under a knife, an orthopedic resident's perspective by B, and it's also permanent free. Obituaries, Joseph S. Torg, 1934 to 2022, and J. Richard Stedman, MD. Now on to the headlines. While we're talking about Antonia Chen talking about total joint cases, how about Andrew Schoenfeld talking about spine articles?
So first off, there's no show prep for this one. This is total zero show prep because I did 17 methods reviews this week for JVJS. My methods review game is crisp, like my suit game, also crisp, Dior to Diadora. Just as an aside, you know, pro tip here, when you're submitting articles and you get the reviews back and the reviewers are asking for things, it's generally a good idea to give them what they're asking for if you can do it. And if you can't, there are all sorts of different strategies about how to negotiate that. But what's not a good one a not good one is to say things like the reviewers or methodology editor don't know what they're talking about. Because it's not, you know, like the review process is not some kind of ritualized dance. It's not the Lambada. It's not, you know, we're not going through this. Just when you say something like that, that's like inflammatory, then it's like that Key and Peele episode. So here's another box off the, where they have the MMA fighters, you know, doing their intro lines. And he's like, I'm gonna mess this guy up. And then the other guy like takes it all seriously. And he's like, wait, he knows we're just like going back and forth here. Like this is, we're just trying to get people interested in the fight. Did you find an actual crazy person for me to fight? Did you find an actual crazy deputy editor reviewing my article? Yes, they did. They did indeed. And we'll continue the review now with clinical and surgical characteristics of patients with atlantoaxial dislocation in the setting of sandwich fusion, a case control study. And that's not to infer that this is that article that I'm talking about. This is not an article that I was involved in any way in the review process. And point of fact, as it turns out, two of the senior authors, Weishi Li and Shengling Wang, were both research fellows at MGH when I was there as a clinical fellow. So I go way back with the individuals on this article. I won't hold back, though. So this is an interesting study looking at the clinical and surgical characteristics of patients who have rare proximal surgical conditions. The patients with sandwich fusion, that's a concomitant C1 occipitalization and C2, C3 non-segmentation. It's a subtype of Klippel file. And these are rare clinical entities. They have specialized centers where both of the senior authors, you know, work at, where they really collect from a very large population, that these are specialty referral centers where they're really experts in just kind of working in that, you know, proximal occipitocervical, proximal cervical region. Like these guys are expert working in that space. They're comparing the results. They have like 131 patients with the sandwich fusion. They assemble a control cohort that's somewhat heterogeneous. And this is, you know, essentially a retrospective clinical epidemiology type study. We've covered these in the past. This group has a great clinical expertise. There's expertise at the operative level. There's expertise probably in the OR support team and on the floor in the individuals who are managing these patients, because it's, again, a highly, highly specific, specialized referral center. And you need something like that to get sufficient number of cases of this type even. So you couldn't have this study without a center like this. That being said, the results of this study aren't necessarily translatable to someone who does just a couple of these every decade or something like that. I mean, because that's really what it comes down to. These are very rare clinical procedures. And it is a heterogeneous cohort that they're comparing to. I think that the control group is kind of, you know, they wanted to have level 3 evidence, I think. And so they have this control cohort. I'm not sure that that's really necessary. That gives you that much information. I think it's always challenging when you have a paradigm. And we actually see this quite regularly in other papers. So I think it's a good thing to point out. When like you compare outcomes or results of a condition in individuals to another group that doesn't have the problem that those individuals have. So these individuals have sandwich fusion, a rare Klippel file entity, and now you're comparing them to another group. And so how do you counsel the patient? Oh, based on this study, you would do better or worse than this other group that doesn't have your problem. Like, I mean, how does that make, you know, when we see it with like total joint arthroplasty, you know, total hips, total knees, they'll be like, oh, we compared patients with psoriatic arthritis or seronegative spondyloarthropathy undergoing joint replacement to patients with osteoarthritis. Same thing. Like you just say like, well, you have psoriatic arthritis, but your risk of infection is 3 times higher than if you didn't have it. Okay. So what are you going to do with that? Right. Like first off, it's comparing to a referent that individual can't even sort of, you know, wrap their head around. It's not directly relevant to patient care. So I would really question whether this is level 3. I'd say it's probably more level 4 evidence. And most of their findings are, you know, their main conclusions are characterizations around this procedure. They're not going to help someone make the determination about what the optimal approach for this case is. So, you know, they say patients with sandwich atlantoaxial dislocation demonstrated distinct clinical manifestations, versatility involving the use of various internal fixation techniques, transoral release procedures frequently necessary, meticulous and personalized preoperative planning is of paramount importance. I mean, these are all kind of non sequiturs. Like, it's sort of, you know, what surgery doesn't require meticulous preoperative planning? Yeah, you can just show up and just do it. Like,
yeah, good luck with that. I'm sure you'd want right, that exactly. to make you, right? Exactly.
I think it's very interesting, again, because of the numbers, their experience to just have, you know, they have some great clinical pictures, definitely worth checking out. How much it impacts patient care, directs clinical practice, I don't think it can too much. And then certainly if you're considering a case where you have to do this sort of thing, it might be helpful to review that article. And I think that's why it's published here. But that's my take on it.
Under rare conditions, it's good to see the literature, but you know, it's one of those things where how useful they are depends on what you have in front of you. So I agree.
Not so check another bingo on the card as you give your headline.
Well, I was just about to say, mine is the opposite of that. Mine is a lot more performed in patients, which is unicompartmental knee replacements, not as much as total knee compartments. Thank you, bingo. Check. You can put that on the letter or the card there. Depends where you want to put it. We can make 5 in a row. So I'm talking on similar survivorship, but different revision reasons for uncemented mobile bearing and cemented fixed bearing medial UKAs, a long-term population-based cohort study of 2,015 patients by Tay et al. There is a commentary, whether or not you agree with them, agree with us, or have your own opinions is totally up to you. So we know that more and more partial knee replacements or UKAs, unicompartmental knee replacements, medial or lateral, are being performed and longer-term follow-up is important. And this study looked at 3 different types of bearing surfaces. So a cemented fixed bearing, uncemented mobile bearing, and cemented mobile bearing partial knee replacements. And looking over 2,000 cases in a single center. I'm sorry, not a single center. It's a single center, but they have a single insurance system. This is done in New Zealand. So in theory, there should be better follow-up. So it's not a single center study. They looked at 49 different surgeons. So the hardest part about this study is you don't know why each of these implants was placed in there, right? You don't know why one surgeon did cemented versus uncemented versus mobile bearing versus fixed bearing. And most of the time it's surgeon preference, right? That's really what it comes down to in surgeon comfort level of doing these procedures. But there is no, you know, set guide. This is not a randomized controlled trial, randomizing people to different types of fixation. This is definitely biased towards cementless total knee replacements. In the cementless total knee replacement group, the cementless mobile bearing. So the cementless was only available in the mobile bearing, and the cemented was available in both mobile bearing and fixed bearing. And in the uncemented group that represented over 1,000 of the cases, 450 had 2 different implants that fell into the cemented fixed bearing group. And then the cemented mobile bearing group was almost 500 patients. So there was a slightly uneven distribution. They did say the follow-up was 2 to 20 years with regards to a range with a minimum of 2-year follow-up, which is good for an implant. But the title says that it's a long-term study. So it's not really a long-term study. I think if you're saying 2 years minimum follow-up, normally when you need long-term follow-up, you're saying 10 years minimum follow-up or longer. So they could have excluded some patients technically if you were looking for longer-term follow-up. But they did look at survivorship and found that implant survivorship overall was 85%. It was 92% for cemented fixed bearing, 91% for uncemented fixed mobile bearing, and 80% for cemented mobile bearing designs. So the greatest revision risk was in cemented mobile bearing patients. And other reasons for revision mostly fell with regards to age. The younger you were when you underwent a unicompartmental knee arthroplasty, defined as less than 60, had a higher revision rate compared to patients who were greater than 70, which is probably not that surprising. One, because you know you're going to live longer, so you're likely to undergo revision. Maybe if you're older and let's say either your component starts failing or you develop arthritis in another compartment, you don't undergo surgery because you don't want to undergo another surgical procedure. The 3 main reasons for revisions were osteoarthritis progression, which is 36% of all revisions, aseptic loosening, which is 20%, and bearing dislocation was 17%. Now, keep in mind, bearing dislocations really only happens in mobile bearing implants, not the fixed bearing implants. But the osteoarthritis progression at 15 years was 4-fold higher for cement mobile bearing and uncemented mobile bearing compared to uncemented mobile bearing compared to cemented fixed bearing. So their thought process was for the fixed bearing implants, at least they're less prone to overcorrection because of implant design and surgical technique. So potentially that could be part of the case here too, where the technique was a little bit off. And then assuming that most of these surgeons have done a lot of these, the other thing too is suboptimal patient selection. So the one thing that I thought would be really helpful in this study is they talked about having radiographic analysis. And it sounded like they did the radiographic analysis for the postoperative one to see if there was OI progression or failure of the implant, say maybe aseptic loosening. And that is nice because they can actually get images as opposed to big registry studies where you can't get the images. But they didn't use the images preoperatively, which I think would have been really helpful. So if they use preoperative image, maybe a patient did have medial and lateral compartment wear, but they got a medial uni, probably not the best thing for that patient. So OI progression was very likely to happen. And was that more true in patients who got cemented mobile bearing implants? I don't know, but it's one of those things that leaves a question where if you have the radiographs, it'd be really nice to see that. Aseptic loosening was higher in cemented wet fixed bearing and mobile bearing. And bearing dislocations were twofold higher with uncemented implants compared to cemented mobile bearing implants. A few of them occurred within the first 6 months, but most of them, which is 61%, occurred at greater than 2 years. And aseptic loosening was significantly higher for younger patients compared to older patients, again, defined as less than 60 years old and 60 to 69 years old versus greater than 70 years old. So this is a study that says, you know, looking at mobile bearing, fixed bearing, and looking at cemented and cementless. The cementless fixed bearing components, there's only one approved of in the United States right now. So it'd be interesting as the time goes on to have all four groups compared, ideally in a prospective randomized controlled trial manner. I know that's kind of a slick way out to say, oh no, further studies are needed, randomized controlled trials. But it would really actually be interesting to see these patients, see them followed up for.
Total cop out.
I admit it, at least. I fully embrace it and admit the fact that it was a cop-out, but it would be nice to see a comparison of all the different type of implants. And the other thing too is I'm curious what the findings would be if they were not in surgeons who had great experience in doing unicompartmental knee replacements. A lot of our unis are potentially and total knees and total hips are done in patient with surgeons who do less than 50 of these procedures per year, especially in the unicompartmental knee arthroplasty category. So I'm curious if surgeon experience also had an impact on this. And I would love to see the results of that as well too. So if they could add surgeon experience into this, years in practice or number of procedures performed at the time that this patient underwent surgery would be really interesting to elucidate. There you go. Take home message is once we have the mobile bearing cementless, maybe something to consider using in practice. And moving on to another wonderful joints topic.
In your case is on hold featurette. Check out the big brain on Brad.
Check it out. Because you're looking at hyponatremia is an overlooked sign of trouble following total joint arthroplasty by Baker et al. So interestingly enough, if you look at the introduction, there are a lot of studies that have looked at hyponatremia and total joint arthroplasty, which is interesting because as a joint surgeon, I probably don't look at my sodium levels as closely as I probably should. I look more at hemoglobin, hematocrit. I look at albumin levels. I look at a lot of other variables, but sodium is not the one that really grabs my attention.
I guess that's why they're saying it's an overlooked sign of trouble. Of course, this study didn't measure whether it was overlooked or not.
Because they were looking at it. They were actually looking at it.
And so they actually say that hyponatremia in other studies has been found to be present in this population in between 18 and 85%. So a small group or everyone?
It's like, I'm right. 0 to 100% of the time.
Right.
So good luck with that. Figure that one out. So they define hyponatremia as a serum sodium level of less than 135 milliequivalents per liter. In this study, what was a little bit different of this study versus other study is they took four different groups, and then they also had subcategories.
So this is from Jefferson.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they were classified into four groups. It was normonatremic and normomatremic, meaning before surgery and after surgery.
They four had groups that I would say no one uses these terminologies.
Normonatremic. Hyponatremic is a term. That is
fair. Oh, no, it is, but it's not like you're normonatremic. You're normal hyponatremic. You're hyponatremic. Like this is the first time I'm ever seeing this paradigm in the literature.
I'm going to go get a BMP after this and find out what it is. When I undergo surgery, I'll find out what it is afterwards. I'm going to
You could have been normonatremic pre your cases on hold, and now you're hyponatremic.
I need some electrolytes. I'm going to get some afterwards. Right. So normo, and then you said normonatremic and hyponatremic. hyponatremic, and then you became normonatremic after surgery, and then hyponatremic and hyponatremic, but the four different groups. And they looked at 3,000 primary and revision total joint arthroplasties, the majority being primaries, as you can imagine, and about 500 being revision ones. In the groups, the normonatremic one, which they didn't overlook their sodiums, was the majority of it, almost 85% of patients. And so then the numbers become much smaller as you keep going down. It's 9.4% in the group that was normal hyponatremic. In the group that was hyponatremic and normonatremic, it was 2.1%. And the last group was 3.8% for the hyponatremic. So 13.2% of patients had hyponatremia after total joint arthroplasty. They then took another step further and looked at subgroup analysis. They looked at patients who had postoperative serum levels, serum sodium levels of less than 130, and then 130 to 134.9, and then 134 to 145. And they examined primary total joint arthroplasties that underwent surgery, and then they were normalized after surgery if they were found to have a low sodium. So we corrected them, and they wanted to see if there was a difference in outcomes. So the findings, which are probably not super surprising, are these were patients who had a high risk for postoperative hyponatremia, older patients, hip arthroplasty, general anesthesia, which normally ties or correlates with a higher Charleston comorbidity index, congestive heart failure, revision surgery, and a history of stroke, liver disease, and chronic kidney disease, organs that help regulate your sodium, especially when it comes to your kidneys. So that's not super, super surprising. And those who had postoperative hyponatremia had higher likelihoods of having 90-day complication and non-home discharge and greater length of stay. Again, because it's probably a marker of a patient who's less healthy than someone who's very healthy. So is it really the sodium that makes a difference? And that's why they looked at patients who are corrected. Or is it a fact that it's a harbinger or a marker of general health? So they found that group four had a greater, threefold greater likelihood of non-home discharge, and group two had a almost twofold greater likelihood of non-home discharge. And then group four had a 2.6-fold greater likelihood of overall 90-day complications, and group two had over a 2.1-fold greater likelihood of overall 90-day complications, but it was similar in primary revision patients. And then we know that decrease in sodium, or a greater decrease in sodium, right? We looked under the 130, had greater risk of any complications, medical complications, surgical complications, non-home discharge, and increased length of stay. Not a surprise. If they normalize the sodium, so they basically said, oh, you have low sodium, we're going to correct it. That time to correction is obviously going to increase your length of stay. And they had greater rates of non-home discharge, probably because they were in the hospital longer, ended up going to like a rehab facility or something like that. So, you know, group four was the worst, hyponatremic. What they didn't explore, which would have been nice to see, is what if you were normonatremic prior to surgery? Would that make a difference, right? Would that pull you from group four to, you know, group two, right? Or the group that basically goes from normonatremic to hyponatremic, or, you know, then you become normonatremic or normonatremic. So, you know, does preoperative correction make a difference as opposed to just looking at afterwards when it's an after the fact lab value that you're not going to do a lot about, and it's not going to really change management?
You know, so the first thing about this study is that most of what they talk about, starting from the title, they're not actually doing and they're not showing. So they're you know, I guess from the introduction and the things you said, it sort of goes without saying that hyponatremia is overlooked, but they didn't actually prove that it's overlooked. And it's probably not actually overlooked in this, at Jefferson, in their center, since they're measuring it in, you know, all these patients, right? Then they're not showing an independent effect of hyponatremia. They're running a regression analysis with the kind of standard, you know, age, anesthesia, comorbidity scores. So that it's not an independent effect of the correction of the sodium. It's just the ability to correct the sodium or not. Because presumably they weren't just ignoring the sodium levels. I mean, I don't know, maybe some surgeons were, I'm not sure. But it certainly seems like they're obtaining these information standardized beforehand. And if you're going to get information, you know, presumably they're acting on it. So there is a selection bias to some degree, because you're not seeing the people whose sodium was so bad that they said, we can't do your surgery right now, come back later, right? Right? They decided in patients in group four and group three that were hyponatremic preoperatively,
still underwent surgery.
They said, well, we'll just, you know, we'll power through. We'll get it done. And, you know, some of the way this is presented is, I call this the home shopping paradigm. right? Like when you're watching Home Shopping Network and they show you a product that they're very enthusiastic about, but you never thought you needed it. And as they're talking about it, you're like, do I really need this? Like, have you thought about hyponatremia and total joint patients? You're like, well, probably, yeah. I mean, it seems like there's good. Well, we're going to tell you about it. We're going to tell you about it in this whole new way. And you need to adopt these parameters. And most of what they're talking about are, again, non sequiturs. Like, surgeons should identify patients who have sodium abnormalities. I mean, okay, surgeons should identify patients who have conditions writ large that are at going to put you at high risk for suboptimal outcomes after surgery. And, you know, in the pre-op clearance visit, either with the surgeon or with the surgical center, you know, when they go through that general medical check, they're getting BMP, they're getting the CBC, like they're going to find these things. So pay attention to those things when they find them. I don't think you needed this study to necessarily tell you that, right? And then, it's kind of like the, they're like, dare me to study hyponatremia and total joints, bruv? And you're like, no, I don't dare you. They're like, oh, no, you totally dared me. Now I have to do it.
Double dog dare you.
Right, exactly. So like, you know, they're really all in, and this is patients who have postoperative hyponatremia. It is not necessarily the hyponatremia itself that are causing these things. I think there are a whole bunch of other reasons why the patients may have had complications, greater length of stay, non-home discharge. In individuals where you can correct the hyponatremia, that general patient milieu, that individual that has that complete physiologic makeup that allowed for that correction, is probably what's driving these determinations rather than the singular correction of it alone, based on the way this study was done. My conclusion of this work is that randomized controlled trials need to be done for correction of hyponatremia. No, it's not. That's not my real conclusion. But if that were the conclusion, if you were to do a randomized controlled trial where you say, okay, I mean, it will never be done, but again, and I understand that this is just a hypothetical to prove the point, where you have, you know, patients who are balanced across everything else except these individuals are hyponatremic, and then you correct their sodium and then you don't correct their sodium,
right?
And see what happens. That would show the independent effect.
Right.
Anything beyond that, there's so much potential for residual confounding from myriad factors that are playing into this. So, you know, the title, like journalistic titles, I'm never a fan of them. You know, it's this title, hyponatremia, is an overlooked sign of trouble. What is trouble? You didn't show it's an overlooked sign.
Dun, dun, dun. Doomsday.
The conclusions are that, you know, it's greater length of stay. What complications? Complications is this, you know, amalgamated category. People don't sustain complications. They get infections. They get VTED. They get UTI. They get pneumonia. So these, you know, complications and non-home discharge. Yeah.
Agreed. So you put this case on hold?
Dr. Soprano from anesthesia says the case is in his trunk, actually. Ooh,
hold out. Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Anesthesia, for your kind, biting, yet insightful words. And moving on to that wonderful things, our honorable mentions, deep gluteal pain syndrome, endoscopic.
Cases never go on hold. The honorable mentions, they don't ever go on hold.
You should be happy to be an honorable mention, guys. Deep gluteal pain syndrome, endoscopic technique, and medium-term functional outcomes by Parodi et al. There's a visual summary for this, and it's free for 30 days. It shows that endoscopic release of the sciatic nerve by resection of fibrovascular bands without piriformis tenotomy is a technique with good to excellent functional results, comparable with those of techniques in the literature incorporating piriformis tenotomy. Effects of CCR2 knockout on tendon biomechanical properties in a mouse model of delayed rotator cuff repair by Eliasberg. The CCR2, which is the CC chemokine receptor type 2 knockout, may potentially improve tendon biomechanic properties by decreasing macrophage infiltration and/or by suppressing inflammatory mediator pathways in the setting of delayed rotator cuff repair. We also have 10 to 13 results of Delta Ceramic on Ceramic Total Hip Arthroplasty in patients less than 30 years old by Park et al. There's an infographic on this. And the long-term results and survivorship of Delta Ceramic on Ceramic Total Hip Arthroplasty in patients less than 30 years old were favorable. There were no bearing fractures. And the survivorship-free reoperation was 92.4% at 13 years. And finally, we have interpretation threshold values for the Oxford Hip Score in patients undergoing total hip arthroplasty advancing their clinical use. This is by Harris et al., also with infographic. And this study established interpretation threshold values for the Oxford Hip Score and may prove beneficial for registry-based evaluations of treatment qualities or any other studies that incorporate the Oxford Hip Score with minimal clinical indifference thresholds that are established in this paper. Thanks again for another exciting episode. And you have to bring your bingo card next time when you listen to us talk.
That was just Dr. Kardashian from anesthesia asking if your case is on hold, yes or yes.
Yes and yes.
Seriously, if you agree with what we said, remember the takes are hot, sometimes intentionally so. Just take everything with a grain of salt. But if you do agree, join the tens of others at Your Case is on Hold who have subscribed to our podcast. Like, hit the notification bell. If you didn't like what we had to say, thanks for listening anyway. And we'll try to do better next time. So we'll see you in June.
Peace.